Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Every week there's somebody wonderful talking about something interesting, and people do have love letters lurking in their hearts. And sometimes the issue is just deciding which of life's experience holds the seed of the love letter you want to write at any particular time. I'm going to go to my guest today, Robert Anasi, who is a writer, and I'm not going to tell you anything about him because I'm going to go right to him. Robert, why don't you just talk about yourself? And I'm particularly interested in how you grew up a little bit and where and how you came here and about boxing and writing. Go.
Do we have all day?
No, I wish we did.
Okay, my name is Robert Anasi. I'm
a writer. Oh, I'm sorry, I pronounced it wrong. Anasi, okay.
That only makes you like everybody else. I'm a writer and a journalist. Right now I'm living in Los Angeles, but, you know, I lived for over 20 years in New York City. I lived in San Francisco for a couple of years after college. And I was born and raised in Providence, Rhode Island. I would say when I was a kid, my parents were very blue-collar Irish Catholic family in a blue-collar Irish Catholic neighborhood where they and their parents and grandparents had lived for over 100 years.
That sounds very nice and stable, was it?
Stable, you know, nuclear family, kind of old-fashioned.
When did you know that you were going to be a writer, and how did they feel, and what did they want you to be?
The great thing about my parents is that they didn't care what I did as long as I was happy.
There was never
any pressure.
That's nice.
And I wanted to be, I was one of those kids with my nose in a book from, you know, age 6 or 7 and just reading all the time, which is probably why I'm so nearsighted.
I don't think that's how it works, but...
And they want, you know, it's just all I really ever wanted to do. And
do you remember the first thing you ever wrote?
I started keeping a journal in high school, like at the recommendation of
English
teacher.
I didn't know if you were one of these little kids.
Prodigies.
Well, no, not that necessarily, but you know, who just wrote things down every day and wrote little stories. But in high school,
I started keeping a journal, and that was kind of the impetus. And, you know, I kept extensive journals for the next 25 years, and those turned out to be extremely useful.
Oh, so were they a focus on something in particular?
No, but, you know, places would, you know, if I was somewhere interesting, that would become the focus of it. So living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which, I did the memoir about, I had...
Start off, just take a minute and tell us the name of your book and where we can find it.
Okay, the latest book is called Last Bohemia, Scenes from the Life of Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And it's about kind of the transformation of this neighborhood in Brooklyn from this...
Where you lived.
Where I lived.
Well, let's get up to there. Did boxing come first?
Boxing came first.
Can you tell us about you and boxing? Because you wrote about that also, no?
Yeah. I was living in San Francisco, you know, in my early 20s, just after college. And I went through a bad breakup, and I was... really angry, you know, and, you know, I had a lot of testosterone, as young men are wont to have. And, you know, I really felt challenged, you know, this breakup kind of challenged me in my masculinity. I felt inadequate. I was dating this rich girl and, you know, I couldn't give her the things she was used to, the things she wanted. And I felt like I had failed somehow.
What? Can we talk about that for
a minute? Sure.
Because... rich girls need love too. I mean,
if
she had all these things, why would you have to give them to her?
Well, I think she was, you know, she had been told by her father, who was this cantankerous old Hollywood character, like, you need, you know, a man's got to be able to do this, this, and this for you. I didn't know, you know, at 23, you just think, oh, you know, I'm falling short. I didn't realize that I would, you know, at 23, you're not a man, you know, even though you're dying to be one. So you kind of...
But then there's the lesson to learn that you have other things to give.
Yes.
Okay. So boxing.
I was getting into...
You wanted to punch somebody.
I wanted to punch somebody. I was getting into a lot of fights, you know, bar fights.
Oh, you
and
were.
Street scuffles and altercations with roommates, you know, and I had for a long time, you know. I grew up with a fair amount of trauma and abuse in my childhood household. And I walked into a boxing gym over on Leavenworth, you know, an old fashioned, you know, punching bags, old trainer like Burgess Meredith in Rocky. And, you know, he's like, well, let's see what you got, kid. And he wrapped my hands up and had me hitting a punching bag, and I just fell in love with it. I was like, I was meant to do this.
Now, for what reasons other than wanting to punch somebody? I mean, there's more to boxing than that.
Well, it's the most difficult thing I've ever done,
in
learning
what way?
How to box. You know, to become proficient at it, you have to suffer so much, both in the training and you get beaten up so many times. Like, you take serious beatings again and again and again. And as one of my first trainers said to me, you know, before the very first time I sparred, he said, well, this is the real test. You know, most people, when they get punched in the face,
don't come back for
more. They walk out of the ring. They're like, this is bullshit. Yeah. I want nothing to do with this. But he's like, a real boxer, you punch him in the face and he almost kind of likes it. And it was true. I was not, you know, discouraged. Mm-hmm. It just made me want to master this art more.
Okay, so you, that's kind of interesting, I think. You go from being angry to wanting to master an art. That's a really lovely shift.
Well, I think boxing does that for a lot of kids who mm-hmm. are, you know, it's the last, you know, rung of the ladder they can grasp before they fall into, yeah. you know, lives of crime and violence.
I could see, I used to be a fencer, and right. I could see the similarities.
Yeah, well, fencing's a martial art also.
Oh, I guess so, yeah.
But
I mean, the grace and the balance and a lot of things that you have to master, as you say. Okay, so how long did you do that? What did you end up writing about?
Well, I boxed pretty seriously for, I'd say, about a decade.
Oh, and my goodness.
I had a fair number of fights. I was, you know, I was in the Golden Gloves twice. I made it to the semifinals once. I was pretty serious about it. But
really
what started me writing about boxing was, you know, I was fascinated by the sport, but then I became equally interested in the kind of milieu of the sport. I mean, boxing's been dying in this country for a long time, for 30, 40 years, and I felt like I had this look into a different America. It was, you know, a disappearing America, but it was also, you know, there were, especially in New York City, there were plenty of, like, blue-collar kids, you know, ethnic kids who saw, you know, mostly African-American, Puerto Rican, and Dominican, but some white guys, or mostly ethnic white guys, like, you know, from old Italian neighborhoods mm-hmm. or old Irish neighborhoods who, you know, saw boxing as kind of their chance and their way out.
To celebrity and earning a living?
To being mm-hmm. stars, to being celebrities. Mm-hmm. They couldn't, you know, they'd gone to crappy schools, they dropped out of school.
Why has it diminished? I mean, listening to you, I want to go to a boxing match now.
It's a long story. I mean, I think the rise of MMA has mixed martial arts, you know, has really put a nail in the coffin.
Oh, I see.
But it was dying long before then, and I think the big reason is that, you know, it has a lot to do with the themes of my second book, but, you know, boxing is an urban sport, and the center of boxing was urban cultures and these, you know, ethnic immigrant neighborhoods, and part of becoming American was, like, learning how to, you know, boxing is an American sport.
Now, we can get this more in your book?
Yes.
Okay, so will you please tell us the name of that book?
The new book.
The boxing book.
The boxing book is called The Gloves, A Boxing Chronicle.
Okay.
Yeah, and that takes up, you know, that kind of takes up basically the 2 years I spent in New York training and competing in the Golden Gloves.
That sounds really worth reading.
But also really focusing on, you know, my trainer, who was this kind of con artist hustler. Uh-huh. And the fighters in the gym who were, you know, we had a 17-year-old middleweight named Victor who the summer I came to train with them, he was a Crip and he'd gotten into a gang fight on the subway and someone had carved him open from his navel to his breastbone and he loved it. You know, he loved having that scar. And he would always train with his shirt off so you could see this giant,
I thought you were
going to
say he died on the bus.
And Victor would bring, like, Uzis to the gym. He'd be like, come over here, look, check this out.
Okay.
I got a Tech 9.
It's a compliment, a complicated business.
Yes.
I mean, so many things go into the need for it. Talk about Brooklyn.
Well, I moved to, I actually lived in Brooklyn when I first got out of college in 1989, and I lived in Bed-Stuy, and I might have been, like, the only white guy in a 50-block radius. And it was, you know, it was a tough urban neighborhood, and being a white kid, you stood out and had some trouble on the streets. And But I was kind of drawn to it, and it was also where I could afford to live. But then in the, you know, I was living in Washington Heights up on 169th Street after I moved back to New York when I was 27. And it was, we called it upstate Manhattan. It was so, you know, 169th Street. I would, you know, I would take the train home after going out with my friends on the weekend. I'd fall asleep. I'd wake up on 207th Street. I just thought, this is too far away. Can't live up there. And then friends of mine were like, oh, I have this, you know, I couldn't afford to live in the East Village. The East Village was being gentrified. Mm-hmm. My friends were like, you should move. My friend was like, you should move in to, with me to Williamsburg. And I said, what's Williamsburg? But it was cheap. And, you know, and it was one stop away from Manhattan. And I got there and I thought it was perfect.
Well, tell us, what's Williamsburg and why the interest in, there seems to be a lot of interest in the revival. I shouldn't even say the revival of Brooklyn, but Brooklyn as a place.
Williamsburg is a, you know, neighborhood in northwestern Brooklyn. It was an industrial, you know, a factory center, an industrial center for, you know, most of the 20th century. The Domino Sugar plant was there.
So what is it that you're focusing
Pfizer
on?
Pfizer Chemicals.
You were talking about the changes. And you liken them actually to changes in San Francisco. Do you want to just talk about changes for a little bit?
Sure.
I think that's...
Well, basically, in the time that, you know, I'd say from like 1988 to 2008, Williamsburg changed from this semi-abandoned industrial neighborhood that, like a Rust Belt, it was a Rust Belt town in the middle of New York City, mm-hmm. to, you know, then it went through a stage as this kind of little artist mecca that not many people knew about, that was cheap, and you could get warehouse space so you could make work there, and there was this little community of artists and freaks and other, you know, eccentrics, and then it turned into, you know, this hot tourist destination, and in...
because it's authentic? I mean, people
you know,
tend to be drawn to something that's authentic, and then it stops being authentic.
Yeah, and then, you know...
What happens?
Ed Koch, you know, former mayor of New York, said, you know, we want artists to make neighborhoods so good that they can't afford to live in them anymore.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of the...
And it is so often the artists that go there first.
Of course.
So often.
Because they're looking for space, they're looking for a cheap place to live.
And then they make it beautiful and interesting.
You know, when I lived in San Francisco in the early 90s, I lived in a three-bedroom Edwardian place on Broderick McAllister, you know, right over the panhandle. And the rent for the entire flat was $725 a month, which meant, as a young writer, you know, I was teaching ESL. I worked 10 hours a week. I made $1,000 a month. And I had plenty of time. You know, I had enough money to live and plenty of time to work on my writing. And I don't see how that's possible for young artists anymore in places like New York or San Francisco or...
Oh, that's right.
Or London or Paris. I mean, this is an international phenomenon.
Right. Because I just read yesterday, a friend of mine was talking about a two-bedroom, two-bathroom apartment in an area that's prosaic. I mean, it's not a glamorous area, and it was $5,000 a month.
That sounds about right.
It's insane. But so what is the focus of your book when you're talking about, on Brooklyn, you're talking about changes, is that right?
Well, I focus on this, you know, I think anyone who was there at that time would have written a different book. I focused on people. I made sure one of my ideas was that I was only going to write about people I knew.
Well, so how does that grab you that you want to write about it?
Well, what grabs me about writing about is when you come back to a place like San Francisco after not having been here for 10 years or not having lived here for 15 years and just seeing, it's almost unrecognizable. I mean, even in terms, especially in a place like Williamsburg, less than San Francisco because it's all historically protected, but you could walk down a street you lived on in Williamsburg now and you wouldn't even know you lived there. You know, everything is different. There are high-rise condos.
Oh, is that, I shouldn't be doing this because it's your story and I shouldn't be groaning, but is it disturbing?
It's disturbing, but more than just saying, oh, it was better before and we had it great and it sucks now. My point is this world doesn't exist anymore, and unless someone writes it down, it's going to be completely forgotten. You know, it's written on the air. It's just contained in memories and what people saw or what people did, and kind of the role of the writer is to preserve this.
I was going to ask you about that. So you're taking the role as the narrator. Not so much Rip Van Winkle.
Well, it wasn't all written. You know, it's not all written from my point of view. You know, uh-huh. I present three or four artists who lived there during that time, or not even artists. Like, I do have one character who grew up in the neighborhood, you know, and his parents and grandparents lived in Williamsburg. And he always felt like he was an outcast because he wanted to play music and he was writing and everyone was just, you know, like tough street kids. And they were like, why don't you talk like us? He didn't have a Brooklyn accent. And he was like, I never felt like I belonged. And then all of a sudden all these artists started showing up and I felt like the world came to me.
Oh.
You know, he would look at Manhattan and he'd be like, I'm in this totally dead town right across the, and it, you know, it has the best views of Manhattan in all of New York City. And he'd look across the river and feel like, I'll never be part of that. But, you know, it ended up coming to him.
So you're not lamenting in any way.
I am lamenting. I think, you know, in our, you know, you have to ask yourself who cities are for.
Mm-hmm.
And our cities used to be, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-class. There were jobs in cities, you know, and good paying blue collar and white collar jobs.
Yes.
And now, I mean, who's benefiting from the, you know, the rediscovery of cities or the gentrification of cities? It's not blue collar people. They're just being shoved out to the outskirts. You know, the new economy.
And how far can they go to outskirts and outskirts and outskirts?
And have to take a 3-hour bus ride to work at Jack in the Box. I mean, it's sad. You know, this new economy only helps a very limited number of people. It is not the kind of economy that we had in the 60s where you could work a factory job and make a middle class.
Oh, or sell shoes at a department store and have a house and a wife and two children.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's, you know, our society is, I'm not the only person who's pointed out, it's increasingly becoming divided into haves and have-nots. And I think places like San Francisco, like Williamsburg, are kind of test cases for what's going on and warning signs.
You know, I'm just a little mute for you for a second because, yes, I find it really upsetting myself. And the crowding, without regard to the implications of that crowding. So do you see any kind of a way around this?
Well, I mean, look at what de Blasio is trying to do in New York City. He just, you know, just presented a plan to the city council to try to create a quarter of a million, like, low income housing inside the city for, you know, the people who have been pushed out. And I think that's
a step. Do you think that'll work?
He's got a lot of obstacles in front of him, but at least he's got the vision, you know, that if something isn't done now, you know, we're just going to keep increasing the divide in this country.
So that's kind of an odd picture to me. I mean, then you have this Manhattan, which is so expensive. It's just insane, I think. And, of course, my list of what's insane is growing longer by the day. But it is insane. You have people who are living these lavish lives. And in the middle of it, you're going to have a housing for how many people?
A quarter of a million.
A quarter of a million people who are going to feel like what?
You know, one of the interesting things about New York is that if you can afford a place to live, it's actually a very affordable city. You know, food is cheap.
Oh.
Services are cheap. Transportation is cheap. It's, you know, right now we've turned New York, places like New York and San Francisco are basically subsidized for the rich to enjoy the benefits. They can use the public transportation. You know, they're not out on Richmond or something having to take the bus or, you know.
Do you consider, I mean, you've been here in San Francisco. What are the changes you've seen here? And do you feel that's true here also, that you can get a place to live, then living is not so expensive?
Yes, I do.
Do you?
I mean, because it's a regional hub, it's just, you know, it's, you know, a lot of the food and markets are distributed through the ports, so food's going to be cheaper there, services are going to be cheaper. You don't need to own a car,
right?
Which is a major
Although our transportation isn't anywhere near good enough.
Well, I believe that, but compared, you know, I live in L.A., so.
Oh, yes, that's worse, right? By the way, they used to have, because I grew up there, and when I was a girl, too many of my sentences start that way, but the bus stop benches always carried ads for mortuaries.
That's,
I don't know if they still do. Well, we all knew that it was because you were going to die waiting for a bus. It was so obvious. But they all had mortuary. It's kind of bizarre. Yes, yeah, so public transportation in L.A. is
it's still heinous.
Worse, yes.
Yeah, and you can't live there without a car. And I never, you know, living in New York, living in San Francisco, I didn't even have a driver's license until I moved to SoCal. And I finally had to get it, and just realizing what an expense it is to own and maintain a car, mm-hmm. and pay insurance, mm-hmm. and pay parking tickets because
gasoline.
And that's like a tax on the poor, you know.
Well,
to live somewhere where you don't have to pay those things is just a major benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what, you know, that's when I'm saying, you know, places like San Francisco and New York are cheap if you can afford the rent. Mm-hmm. It's true. It's, you know, you could live, you can have access to really good food in New York for, in great markets for, mm-hmm. for very, compared to what you pay in, you know, in some more isolated or remote area.
Yeah, I'm not aware of what you pay elsewhere, but, you know, and food's going to be going up anyway because of, I mean, we get into a whole slip slide thing here with, so what do you think these, do you think these books will have any kind of an immediate effect to
no.
make, okay, yes.
I mean, you know, I just would like, you know, I'm hoping, you know, my boxing book was, you know, and usually I write about things, my impetus to writing about things is the same. My boxing book, my Williamsburg book, just something that I saw or experienced mm-hmm. that was remarkable, that was interesting, that, you know, not enough people know about. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's nice to think that you're bringing attention to people in places that haven't gotten the attention
yes,
they deserve.
But I like when you talked about just, you know, you're recording it.
Right.
For future, which is important. I mean, when we look back, do you ever look back at things and say, oh my goodness, thank God somebody wrote that down?
Exactly.
Yes. What kind of things? Do you have a good sense of history in general?
I think I do, for a layman.
Well, I mean, yes. So when you look back, what grabs you? When you look back in time, what grabs you in history?
That's a pretty big question.
It is. I mean, I don't have much of a sense of it myself. I must admit, I have a great big yesterday's news attitude. Because today and what's coming tomorrow just strikes me as so exceptional. But, you know, even things like I got very taken up at one point with Marie Antoinette, poor thing, yes, who was just scapegoated, I believe. And she didn't say, let them eat cake. And she didn't, you know, how history changes things if we're not careful. It's really kind of tragic.
You know, I'm constantly reading, you know, I just read, you know, Wendy Dominger's long book on the Hindus, which was banned in India because because the Hindu nationalists didn't like her portrayal of Hinduism. Mm-hmm. You know, she portrayed it as this open, inclusive, you know, multifactorial, you know, welcoming kind of pantheon of gods and goddesses that changed and had input from women and input from lower class people. And they were like, no, there's only one Hinduism. This is the way it is. But through that book, I was able to really, for the first time, get, you know, a sense of the scope of Indian history and how different their theology and
okay, so
the,
we're
their
to
way
look-
of looking at the divine, and that there's one truth with a capital T. You know, because everyone, we all have different perspectives.
Right, but if you're, the books that you're doing is a truth about, oh, well, so that, you know, that's very much like love letters, actually. It is always true, even if the world changes. It's the truth as you see it at that time.
Yeah,
and
but it's also
worth a lot.
The Rashomon effect, right?
Yes,
if you talk to
yes.
seven people, they're all oh, seven of them are going to
definitely
see something different. But with all seven of those perspectives, you start to get a full picture.
Yes.
One thing I'd like, you know, I did this reading last night.
Oh, please,
with a writer named Bradley Spinelli, who has another Williamsburg book out, Killing Williamsburg, which mm-hmm. is a novel in which suddenly, out of the blue, hipsters in Williamsburg start killing themselves. It's very funny. And it's written some of the same time period when my books, mm-hmm. that my book covers. But it's interesting with Bradley, you know, we vaguely knew each other in Williamsburg at the time. And his book, his novel is like another one of those perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like Williamsburg and this new attention to Brooklyn is kind of create, you know, we're hoping that, you know, there are some other Williamsburg writers too. And, you know, there is attention being focused on this
yes.
kind of lost moment
yes.
in history.
And I think I told you about Lena Misitsi,
right,
who was
exactly.
a guest here, and talks about Brooklyn. And by the time she is through talking for 25 minutes, you just see this what was streets and roads and buildings as really a living entity. It was wonderful.
So does she write about...
Yes. Lena Misitsits. You can look her up. But I want to get back to you for now because this one's yours. If you had to write a love letter right now, who would you write it to? And you've written them before? Do you write love letters?
Actual love letters? Like to people?
Yes. Well, no. I mean, I'm saying that and not necessarily. One of the best love letters I ever saw was written to a store called Filamento. And as the woman who founded it. And as she's reading this thing, I am absolutely in tears. It was gorgeous. It doesn't matter who you write the love letters to because what you're writing about is the love you feel. And it can be one woman wrote a love letter to her horse here. She said it was the only creature who ever listened to her. It was just gripping. So no, it doesn't have to be to people.
That is a good question because I'm writing now about police informants, actually, who are, I'm writing about this police informant who works for federal police agencies and basically sets up criminals to be taken down by the cops. You know,
now, isn't that what they call entrapment?
Well, there are specific laws about entrapment. Like they have to have 3 meetings with them.
Oh, I see.
So after 3 meetings, it's not entrapment anymore because they keep coming back. Yeah. Like if I said, hey, let's go rob a bank right now, and you said, yeah, and I was an informant, that would be entrapment. But if I said, let's talk about it and come back tomorrow and we'll see if we're going to do it, that's where they draw the line.
Okay.
But, you know, this book is opening up a kind of perspective on this insane, like, 40-year history of the war on drugs in the United States, which is now changing and possibly, you know, becoming less onerous. Like, Obama is talking about granting pardons to people who are in prison for, you know, life sentences for nonviolent drug crimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see my work, which I hope will turn to a book on the war on drugs, is kind of a love letter to people whose lives have been ruined by ridiculous laws, Rockefeller drug laws in New York, you know, the 3 strikes law in California, all this stuff. You know, we have people whose lives were ruined for things that aren't even crimes anymore now, like having a pound of pot, and they're doing 25 years. So, you know, I'm hoping that to kind of shed light on what they've suffered and the insanity on this of the war on drugs, even though, you know, my brother's an ATF agent and, you know, he leads their SWAT team in LA and, you know, he spends his days kicking down doors and busting bad guys, many who are horrible people and deserve to be in prison. But, you know, 40 years later, 40 years late after Nixon declared the war on drugs, drugs are cheaper than ever, and all we've done is incarcerate millions of human beings.
Yes.
So, you know, I kind of hope that this will, you know.
Oh, so I have a thought. Then, if this does turn into a book, I hope it will, because I already want to read it. I think that would be a really nice preface, an actual love letter to the people who have been just destroyed by, well, in particular, going to jail for a long time for things that shouldn't be against the law, but that's just my view, or are no longer against the law. Now, if something's this is a whole other issue, but if something's no longer against the law, do they get out immediately?
I don't think so.
With a nice handwritten apology?
I don't believe that's the case.
Gosh, that's awful. Love letters, handwriting is really important, I think. And you see that all the time. People are nuts about letters and handwriting for generations. So I thought of one because I got an email from you, and one of the things we didn't introduce you as is a newlywed.
I am a newlywed.
You are a newlywed. And you had mentioned to me that, I forget exactly how you put it, but it was, if I can find it here, I'm just going to read it because it was wonderful. And it's just, I read this and I thought, oh, love letter to the unborn baby. After many relationship misadventures, she and I finally found each other just in time to make a baby. I couldn't be happier. I just think that is the opening paragraph of a love letter to this baby.
That would be, you know,
You mail to this baby. You don't know gender yet, right?
We do not know.
Okay, so you mail to this baby, and you don't open it. And baby gets to open it, maybe at the age of 6 or 10 or whatever it is. But you can't open somebody else's mail, you know. That's also illegal, isn't it? I think it is. It used to be.
Even if it's your kid?
Yes. Yes, even if it's your kid. So would you consider doing that?
I would. That sounds really touching.
Because you seem to gather experiences and then see when they are fit to go into a book as a valuable piece of information. You could do the same thing with letters.
Well, you know, especially as seeing as, you know, Sarah and I have dated a lot of crazies. You know, we've been knocked around in the love game. So just to find each other has just been to find someone who's like crazy enough to be interesting, but sane enough that you don't think they're going to, you know, drive a car off a cliff is very nice. And I actually just found out
so there's another love letter to that baby.
Yes.
Yes. Go. You just found out what?
Just found out that my last serious girlfriend is on a reality TV show on television, a martial arts reality TV show. And so she's basically getting beat up on TV. It just made me realize how happy I am to be with Sarah and not this other one.
Good. I love Sarah. Sarah's, as you know, the daughter of a lifelong friend of mine. And Sarah is wonderful. Yes. So are you. Thank you for doing this with me.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate this a lot. And I just want to say that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is a special occasion that you can do anytime you have a thought about somebody that you think would be wonderful put to paper and stamped and mailed. So for now, this is Janet Gallen and
Robert Annecy
saying goodbye.